Blizzard, New York. Dude, I've been playing like a kid in the snow.
Nice.
I just, I got my stuff done and I left at like 3 o'clock on Monday and like 4 o'clock yesterday. And I was in my snowboarding gear. I was like walking around the West Village in my snowboarding boots because I don't have any good like waterproof boots or anything. So I was like, whatever, F it. I'm just going to put these things on. So I'm like walking around. I actually felt awesome though, because I'd gone to the office and I've been going to the gym and stuff, and it's just such a pain, you know, the day after a snow, everything's so slushy. Every time you go from the across the street, it's like that disgusting slush.
Yep.
And then I had my snowboard boots on and my pants with my gaiters. So I was just I was indestructible, man. And I was like, I wanted one of those salt trucks to come by and just splash me. I would have just taken it like a man, you know?
Nice.
But it was so fun.
Does New York City still have that, like it's like all white and beautiful, or is it already brown? And
Monday and Tuesday were really nice. Today has been a little bit more brown, but it's still pretty good. Also, there's not as many people, right? So it's not as bad as normal, but it's just kind of that slush. But it is interesting because it's been cold enough that it's kind of stayed on the ground a little bit longer than normal, you know?
Nice.
But, dude, the parks were so pretty. I shared some photos on Twitter and stuff, and it was just like, it's like something out of like Narnia, you know?
Yeah. It's unbelievable.
It's just the light posts and everything and like everything's white and it's really magical in New York, you know?
Nice.
How is it out there?
I can always tell how much it snows by how big like the plow snowbanks are. Mm-hmm. And they're big. It's like, looks like ice caps out there. So,
But I've been in New York for 6 years, and this was the first time that me and my friends, we got some sleds and we went to Central Park. And there's like this place on the east side, basically by like 79th Street and Fifth Ave. And then you start going into the park, and there's like this big hill there, and there's like a ton of people there sledding and like making jumps and stuff. So they're just sitting there all day going down it. And it was great.
Nice. What kind did you get? Did you get like the blow up kind, like the tubes?
Yeah. Yep. There were some blow up ones with like dragons and stuff. And then we actually found like another tube. Some people that I saw had these little half plastic ones, which seemed perfect because they're like small and you just sit on them and ride them down. I was like, I definitely want to get some of those just to have them on deck for next time, you know? But it was great. And then apparently I saw on Instagram there was like this big snowball fight at Washington Square Park. I missed that one, but that one was pretty fun. There was like 200 people just throwing snowballs at each other.
Dude, that's right down the street from you, right?
Yeah.
Like you can get there in like 5 minutes.
Yeah. I went there yesterday and it was beautiful, but it must have just happened earlier in the day because I saw it on Instagram and it was just like, it looked like a good time. But
nice.
Yeah. Cool, man. So, we were off last week, but, back in action this week. I just got back from the office. Actually, I recorded my episode 4 for my Image Cropper series on YouTube. And so I can chat about that. And then, you got some stuff here that you've been working on as well. So, why don't we start with your stuff? 'Cause I think it's pretty exciting actually.
Yeah, definitely. Why don't I start with, I think last episode we talked about Supabase, and I said I was going to check that out, and I did. I actually followed through on something. So it's pretty cool. It's, you know, they advertise it as a like an open source Firebase. I kind of like just wasn't really interested in it because I never felt like I needed an open source Firebase. But, you know, based off our conversation last week, I wanted to check it out. And yeah, it's pretty nice. You click a button on their website and you get a whole kind of backend just automatically set up for you. So they set up a Postgres database for you. They set up an API layer for you. They have auth. And so just right out of the gate, you're flying.
So I'm still kind of confused like where it fits in. Is it a hosted app that they host and you pay them? Is it, you know, even the positioning open source Firebase, I feel like it's just off, right? It's just kind of weird.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I do too, because this, it's funny. This was the thing I was looking for, but I didn't.
You would have known it by looking at the page.
Yeah, I didn't think I needed an open source Firebase. After using it, I can actually kind of understand why they say that, because it is all the things that Firebase offers or will be one day. They're still new. But it's going the direction of all the things that Firebase offers. And I think it's all open source because it's all in GitHub, but I didn't host any of it myself. I didn't, you know, download any of the source code. I used their hosting, like they're just, you know, set up a new account on their website.
And they have a UI for like configuring key. I mean, it's Heroku-like, basically.
Yes, yeah, very Heroku-like. Firebase. No surprise here, very Firebase-like.
Yeah.
So I really liked...
So you were on a free plan. Liked,
yeah, so I think there was some stuff on pricing where I think because they're a new site, they're in beta, everything's free. And if you sign up now and you're like a beta user, you're going to get some discount or something like that when they do start charging. But that stuff is, you don't need to figure out, they haven't figured out yet. So,
got you. But it's the whole platform is open source, so you could run it yourself if you wanted to.
Yes. Yeah, I think so.
It's like WordPress and WordPress.com or Hasura and Hasura Cloud. It's kind of that idea.
Yeah. And they also built, so one thing that like was pretty cool about this is they basically wired a bunch of open source existing tools together. So for the auth stuff, they didn't write their own auth platform. They used, I think it's a thing that Netlify wrote. It's like an open source identity auth. It's a Go library. I forget the name of it. We'll look it up and I'll put it in the notes. Same thing for like the REST API. They use, I think it's called PGREST or Postgres. And that is a way to just turn Postgres tables into REST, like REST APIs.
I thought REST API was dead.
Yeah, well, yeah. So I kind of like that. I kind of like that someone's not reinventing everything from the ground up, right? It's kind of like reminds me of like, you know, entrepreneurs don't like, they don't always just create new things. They can also like just figure out how to bring certain resources together. And that's really what this project reminded me of. And I don't know, I just have a lot of respect for that. Like, I really like that. So yeah, that was cool. And, you know, last week I was saying like, it's just was frustrating when I was building all this stuff on my own that I just was getting stuck with auth. And this, I didn't feel stuck. Like I was writing data to a database and reading it within like, you know, 20 minutes or so. So that was good. Like that felt really good.
That's awesome.
As well as one more thing I really liked about this was their docs. So when you're logged into your account, you can like start editing your Postgres tables, editing your data. And then some of their docs are interactive. So I was writing the podcast editor. So I had a table called episodes. And one of the docs was like, okay, if you want to pull data from here, just copy and paste this JavaScript. And it knew I had the episode table open. So it just filled out everything. So it just like, it sounds so simple. You have no idea how much time that saves you.
Yeah.
Just being able to copy and paste code and not like, you know, like some docs, like they have like open bracket, like your table name here. And it's pretty easy to know your table name, but the more that stuff you have to guess at, it slows you down. So I really like that.
It's the thousand cuts thing, you know?
Yeah. Yep.
That's great. That's really cool. So you were doing that from your React code?
From a Next.js app. Yep.
And it was like they have their own query API, right? It's like a query builder kind of thing.
Yeah. So they have they have their own ORM. And you can do, you know, joins and stuff like that. It kind of looks like GraphQL. In fact, they even have a section of their docs where it's like, we don't support GraphQL, but look how similar our thing is to GraphQL. And they show the GraphQL code and then their ORM code. And yeah, so this was actually like a bummer and kind of a reason that I'm not continuing to use them.
Yeah,
is because, you know, it made me realize that the GraphQL ecosystem and giving up all that tooling.
Yeah.
I just don't want to do that.
So if you went with this, like you wouldn't even use Hasura basically. Because it is a data layer.
You use them for everything. This is where that open source Firebase story starts to make sense. Where it is, if you went with Firebase, you wouldn't use anything else. You would use Firebase for everything. And so that's where I can kind of see where they're getting at this.
Right. So. Got you.
Yeah. So, you know, end of the day, I didn't want to give up GraphQL, all the, everything from like the Mirage testing to like just how great, you know, Hasura and all the GraphQL clients have been,
right.
Just the interop between all these tool sets being GraphQL is just makes life easy.
Too good.
And I didn't want to give that up. And even I don't have anything bad to say about their ORM or my time spent doing that. I didn't want to give that stuff up.
Yep. Makes sense. Cool. Well, it is cool that they seem to have some good product people on board and they can get you to success, you know, pretty quick. I mean, that's kind of like, didn't you say one time that Firebase had people on there that were like, our goal is to get you like writing a query within whatever, you know, 2 minutes or something.
I talked to someone at Firebase a few years ago and they were like, yeah, we have an internal goal to get you like have a successful app within 15 minutes. And I laughed and I was like, well, we worked on a project a few years ago and we were blown away that we like had a successful app in 15 minutes.
Yeah.
So
that's crazy.
You're definitely doing something right.
Yeah, seriously. Cool. So where did your journey kind of take you from there?
So that was it. Once I started doing the ORM stuff and I started doing the joins and I was, you know, just how am I going to test this? How do I get this working with Mirage? Even if it is all just simple REST under the hood, I didn't want to give up the GraphQL stuff. So
Did they have a testing story? Did you happen to look?
I didn't see anything. I didn't look very hard. I don't know. This is not fair to them, but the ORM, I've just been burnt on client-side ORMs. So you asking me to use your ORM is a really big ask.
Yeah.
Where you saying, I provide GraphQL, you can use something like Urkel or Apollo or just write GraphQL queries. That's a lot easier for me to swallow. Now, this is coming from a Rails developer that's going to, you know, scream at you about how you should use ORMs and you shouldn't be writing raw SQL. Client side JavaScript world. Yeah. I want that GraphQL layer.
Yeah. I think that makes sense. I don't know if that's coming through my mic right now, but my radiator is making weird noises. So
nice.
Hashtag New York. I think that's reasonable. The ORM space and data fetching space in the client is just so much more immature than it is in the space like Laravel or Rails and talking to an SQL database. So it's like, even if the ORM is good and they have good docs and everything like that, you just know from your experience, like, what if I want to build an optimistic UI? What if I want to invalidate the cache? Like, what if I want to refresh in the background? Like, all these concerns that come up because of the fact that a JavaScript app is like a distributed app, and we're, as a community, figuring out new ways to handle these problems, and libraries like SWR coming out within, you know, recent times. You can't expect, I'm sure the developers are obviously bright people, but it's not mature enough. So you're going to be limited by whatever Supabase gives you in its APIs. Whereas if something like React Query comes out that you want to use because it has XYZ benefit, then you're kind of barred from that. So that seems reasonable to me.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's basically, you know, that's all I have to add on that.
Okay, but yeah, so where are you headed then?
Yeah, so this spawned another new side project. It's just like a just giant tree of side projects that keep spawning each other.
Well,
I'm at like layer three right now.
Right, exactly.
So this made me realize I don't want to give up GraphQL. I really like Hasura, and so how can I build, you know, our conversation last week, how can I build applications on Hasura where the first week that I start, I'm not just tied down by setting up auth, setting up webhooks, setting up, you know, Auth0 or Firebase, like doing all that integration. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of spec'd out, and I started writing code for this, a project that lets us spin up Hasura instances, have users, have a webhook. So you just click a button, and you basically get Hasura plus auth. And That's where I ended up. So I'm working on that side project. So okay. I can see this tree of just side projects falling out.
Sounds ambitious.
Yeah, it is. So I'm not, one thing I realized is I'm not actually doing any like those subsystems myself. For the auth, I'm using Firebase auth. Their auth is great, right? They have sign up and they have sign in and they have all these different auth providers like
refresh tokens.
Yeah, I don't even have to deal with that. I don't even have to deal with the tokens. So I'm delegating all that stuff to Firebase. And then as far as running Hasura, right now I'm using Google Cloud Platform, which is surprisingly really good. I've never used it before. I've always just sort of defaulted to AWS. But I like what I've seen so far. And I'm kind of bummed that I didn't try this stuff earlier because it's really very cool. Yeah. So they have this thing called Google Cloud Run, and you just paste in the URL to a container and the environment variables that you want to use. So, boom, I have Hasura set up just because there's Hasura is in the Docker registry. There's a URL for it. So I put that URL in, and then, you know, I have the environment variables. What is the database you want to connect to? What is your admin secret? What is your webhook URL? And I can, yeah, it's just that. I just paste those in.
So you're run and it spins up a new instance of Hasura on Google Cloud.
Yep.
So it's not on Heroku.
Correct. It's not on Heroku. It's just Google Cloud. We're going to run this container on our servers. We take care of all that. You just give us a container and the environment variables you want to start it with.
Interesting. Now, when I run, Hasura on Heroku, my projects tell me like when my Hasura thing's out of date. Is that something in the code base of Hasura that's doing a check?
I think so.
Because no one at Heroku knows that I'm running Hasura and right. is managing that at all. It's unmanaged.
Right. And also I would say that this Google thing is similar to Heroku, because with Heroku you are kind of saying I'm running this container with these environment variables.
Yeah.
I think the Heroku thing you treat more as an app, and more you just have a bit,
it's a
more
little
control
of a higher
this.
Level abstraction.
Yeah. Where this is just
what about the fact that Heroku like sets up a database and automatically wires it up for you?
Yeah, so they have that. Google Cloud also has that. They have Cloud SQL. And so I just,
so that's what your button. Thing does. Your button does all that.
Yeah. So
or it will do that.
Yeah, it will. It's doing the user management and the auth stuff. And then I'm setting up the Cloud Run, the container and the database by hand, because those are pretty easy. Just like click buttons to get them.
Okay.
Yeah, but it will, I do want it to get there one day.
Okay.
My vision for this is you, give me a Hasura, give me a Hasura, like give me a Hasura instance that I can use in an app. So for me, that means like Hasura console, a Postgres database, a webhook, and a way to sign up and sign in users. And then I can use Hasura. And so if I can cut out all those steps for every app I build, that's what I'm trying to do with this.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's a users table in the database in your Hasura app or no?
No. So
it's
gets...
just the auth part. It's not the permissions part.
So let me rewind a bit because this gets a little funky. I'm using Firebase for authentication. So all users are stored in Firebase.
Okay.
So if you want to sign up and sign in, you like npm install Firebase. And, you know, they give you those functions.
Mm-hmm.
When you make a request to Hasura, you include, and this is the thing you've done in your project. So you include the Firebase token, which then Hasura is going to hand off to the service that I'm building. And the service that I'm building will validate that token. So that way, yeah, you just, you know, if someone says they're Sam, you can verify they're Sam and that's it.
Cool. And if you wanted additional information with the user, like email or avatar or something, you would then bring that in to your you could do whatever you want with it, but
right. So this is where it gets a little nutty, and this is like my mind was blown by this. But Hasura has this thing called remote schemas. So Hasura says that, like, listen, we're going to run a Postgres database for you, and that's where we're going to write all our data. But if you already have a GraphQL endpoint, we can basically import that and treat it as if it were just another table that we're managing. But we know when it gets things, we're going to delegate to it. So I have the Firebase users as a GraphQL schema that's generated elsewhere.
Yeah.
And then I bring that into Hasura as a remote schema. So from my Hasura instance, I can query all of the users. I can see all their emails, their photos. And it's not synchronizing data. It's not like webhooks that are refreshing themselves. It's literally, you make a request for users to Hasura, and Hasura says, ah, this is a remote schema. I need to get this from Firebase. The goal here is to, and I don't feel that strongly about this, but like one of the goals here is to just not have to think about like, wait, am I pulling this from Firebase? Am I pulling right. this from like an auth service? Am I right. pulling this from Hasura? So just try to hide all those details behind Hasura, because seriously, sending data requests to Hasura is perfect. And just yeah. having everything funnel through that, just that makes life so easy.
I mean, it seems like that's also partly how it's designed to be used.
Yeah.
Front layer, you know, it's like a reverse proxy almost to your data sources, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Like an aggregation. I mean, it really is like, yeah, the BFF, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, not to be confused with the BFG from Doom. Now, what if you wanted to add like an avatar URL property to user? What would that involve?
Well, that's a great question. So Firebase already supports that. So I don't... Firebase, you can do current user.photo URL. And then because I have this remote schema, I think I can just do it. I haven't done this yet, but I think I can do a write to the photo URL to the remote schema, and it will end up in Firebase.
What if you want to add weight or something that's not in Firebase?
So in that... Yeah, that's good. In that one, I would...
make a separate table like user details or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah. User weights or something
like that. I think that's a fine. Or just what if it was user details? Like if it was just a bunch of stuff, you know?
Yep. Yep.
I think that's a fine answer.
And Hasura says you can have joins across these different, like your data and a remote schema. So we can say that like, okay, it's, you know, the users table, it's UID. And in the user details table, it's like users underscore UID or whatever we want to call the foreign mm-hmm, keys there. Mm-hmm.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's really cool. Have you done permissions yet?
No. So I have that. What I'm thinking for that is like the simplest possible case where you'll be able to assign every user a single role. Mm-hmm. This is what Hasura generally recommends in all their docs. So I'm going to start with just three roles: admin, user, and anonymous. And I think mm-hmm. the anonymous, yeah, I'm gonna start with those three roles, and then
nice,
you'll assign those roles to a user in this little web app that manages your users, and then when you're writing your Hasura permissions, you'll use those roles in the permissions. So you'll say that like, I cannot edit this if I'm not an admin, and I can read, you know, anonymous can read this, you know, that sort of
right,
thing. So
right,
that would be like a public, that would be like a blog post table.
Got you. I'm trying to remember what I did with my fitness app. I think it's just if you're auth, then you are a user, and that's it. So that data is not stored anywhere. It's the webhook that's returning in the header your ex Hasura role is user. So
yeah,
that's how it's working behind the scenes for you as well, basically.
Yeah. Like I said, I haven't wired that up, and it's just like the dead simple case. Is what I'm thinking. But yeah, I think it's going to be, yes, admin is something like you assign, and then like user is like you're logged in, and anonymous mm-hmm. is you're not logged in.
Right. Cool. Wow. Very cool.
Yeah.
So it sounds like I could use this potentially in the future in my fitness app.
One of the driving things through this is we have basically three apps: your fitness app, my books app, And then the podcast app that has just never been created.
Never gotten off the ground.
Yeah. I always ask myself is like, you know, I have had your fitness app open as I've been doing this and being like, can Sam actually use this? And nice. I think that's that. If I ever run into anything you can't use, that's like I'm either building something too complex. You know, I need to simplify.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, man. There's just a lot with this, like, with this auth setup. Like, even in Hasura, you have to, like, assign a role to accounts that aren't logged in.
Yeah. And so anonymous, like, X anonymous role, or you have your auth server tell what it is when it's yeah. 404s or whatever.
So you have to name that thing. So in some of our apps, we call it, like, anonymous, and some of uh-huh. them we call it anonymous-user.
Right.
And the docs, they say call it anonymous, but then there's, like, a part where they're like, but you can call this whatever you want, like public. So yeah. it's these. I'm trying to eliminate.
You don't want to have to load that stuff in your brain every time.
Exactly. And as yeah. we jump between our apps, I never want us to have to think yeah. about that. So I'm just, part of the goal here is just, you know, what, like, seriously, what does it take for me to get a Hasura instance and all those pieces? And
right.
Yeah. So I'm really, really am liking building this. I feel like it's kind of like the perfect app for me.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So,
hey man, if you, I'm so glad that you have the energy to wire together cloud services.
Yeah.
You know, the guy who leads AWS just took over as CEO of Amazon from Jeff Bezos. So maybe you're doing the right thing, man.
Yeah.
Maybe it'll pay off, all this tinkering around in AWS consoles and the like.
Dude, I saw something like they have like a 50 something billion dollar run rate with like 28% year over year growth. I mean, it's just AWS is just, it's just a beast. It's that's unstoppable. Insane. Yeah.
That's crazy. Wow. That's awesome, man. I want to use this thing for sure. I think it'd be awesome. Like, I think it would be really fun to just try out like a zero to what's the small fewest number of steps, the smallest number of time to get a next app deployed on Vercel and with a sign in form and yep. auth page with this as your back end. Like, pretty cool, you know?
Cool. Yeah, I think to start, it'll just be the users, and you'll just paste in like a Postgres URL. And so that way, like, you can still continue to use your Heroku running Postgres mm-hmm. and Hasura things.
Right.
And that also gets us a point where we're like, we can actually start using this.
Right.
And then I'll add in the like auto launching cloud run thing. But seriously, doing that stuff by hand is
right. It shouldn't be if you didn't want to use. Right. Right. So if I did want to just do it like I'm used to, click the new
yes.
Heroku app, this will just, it'll give me a URL. I paste it in an environment variable.
Yep. Exactly.
And then somehow I'll have to get the schema in there for the users.
Yeah.
That would so be like a step. I would like paste in, right. I would like add to my GraphQL schema.
You would add to remote Hasura. Schema
thing.
Exactly.
To Hasura. Exactly. And then I would start to be able to like yep. CRUD the users and authenticate them and stuff.
And by the way, you don't even need that because I think in your app, you're not CRUDing the users right now.
Right.
So right. you don't even need that. But that would be like a nice to have.
Yeah. If I want to let people sign up in the app.
So you can still let people do that.
Well, they don't exist. I would have to go to Firebase to create them.
Yes. And you will still have to do that because we're delegating all authentication to Firebase. Mm-hmm. So you will still use Firebase just because they're really good at that.
Yeah,
they are. I mean, they're just.
They're oh, so you're much. Saying in Firebase, they have APIs in the client library to create users.
Yeah, it's gotcha. Literally like Firebase.auth.createuser, sign up with email.
I've only ever done that in their UI, but that's just because I never built anything in my next app. Cool, yep. cool. Yep. Okay, all right. Yeah, that sounds fun.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I think, that'd be awesome.
I think we're going to be very iterative on this, so we'll get to a point where our apps can use it, and then like, what's a nice thing to have, and build that thing in next.
Dude, that would be awesome. I think the next step for me would be to swap it out with that, get rid of my webhook and my API route in my next app, right?
Yep.
Yes, and then exactly. make sure it works for like the existing two users I have, and then create like a sign-up form because I do have other friends who want to get on it, and let them try to sign up and just, it should work. Cause if they, again, like you said, I can just add it with the Firebase APIs.
Exactly.
Then that would work. So now I can query all users, but that's because you're saying I should be able to do that. And if I wanted to protect that somehow, that would be, well, I guess we can, that would be something in Hasura maybe. Like I would, the query would be, would need to be like admin. You need to have permissions in order to query all users. Whereas right now it's completely unprotected for my app because I show them along the top with like their little rings, their little mm-hmm. avatars. Mm-hmm. But let's say I wanted to protect that for some reason or.
I think so. I don't know where the remote schema and auth, how those things interop. The remote schema and the webhook. When you say the word auth, there's like seven different auths yeah. that you could yeah. be talking about. Yeah, it'll be interesting.
And authentication, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we'll use whatever use case you have to drive that.
Nice. Very cool, man. Very cool.
Yeah.
You also had started toying around with Apollo, right?
Yeah. So in order to build this remote schema we just talked about, you know, there's no GraphQL for Firebase. Firebase gives you it's just these wonky APIs. It's APIs written by people that have PhDs in computer science. It's just like,
get me as far away from these people as possible.
It's like fetch all users.
I want like an 18-year-old hacker. He's going to make it way easier.
Fetch all users and pass in a next page token so we know where to get your users from. And it's just like, so you end up writing these like recursive async functions. And you're like, why can't you just give me an all users function? What? Come on. in order to get that remote schema into Hasura, it has to be GraphQL. And so Firebase gives you all these like admin SDK APIs to get all your users. And so I had to translate that to get that into like a GraphQL schema. And so I looked at Apollo server and wow, it is amazing. So first Apollo server, they have a whole bunch of libraries that are like Apollo server Express, Apollo server Koa, Apollo server Micro. Micro
is all node based.
It's all node based from what I saw. I think, yeah, that's just from what I've seen. Micro is the API server that Next uses. So you know the thing where like you export a handler. That's
signature Micro. That API is Micro.
Micro. So of course they have Apollo server Micro.
Oh, cool.
So you just make a Next.js API route, you create an Apollo server, and then you just export it and you're done. Like that's it.
And then within that function, you get to use the admin SDK APIs.
Exactly. So what does it mean to create an Apollo server? Uh-huh. Well, there's two things. There's a schema. So you just literally just write out a GraphQL schema. So I started with just type users and then email and that's it.
Oh, right? Wow.
That's just the simplest thing. And then you write resolvers. So I have a query, I have a query type for, called all users, and it returns, an array of user. I've already defined that type. Mm-hmm. And in the resolver, I just write the Firebase code to get all users. So the thing ended up being like,
do you have to transform it into the GraphQL format and stuff? I mean, that.
No, but I return JSON from the resolver, and then the Apollo server just takes care of it from there. So for example, in my users resolver, since it's an array of user and user is just a single property of email, that's a string. All I have to do is return a list of POJOs that have email. It's really easy.
Wow.
It's like really easy to write. So
okay.
I did that. And then I just progressively added more and more stuff. But I was really impressed with how easy it was. It actually reminded me of React in the sense that like I just had a server in 5 minutes and it wasn't perfect, but I could actually see my users and their email addresses.
You could make a GraphQL request to a GraphQL server that you had implemented and was being hosted in your Next app as an
exactly.
API route. That's
exactly.
crazy. Yeah, I've never written a GraphQL server before. I mean, I've written handlers in Mirage, which is like kind of similar, almost what you're describing, right? But that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, and I mean, just the fact that like Apollo server gives you that all those like different types of frameworks, so you're not thinking like, oh, I have this Apollo server function. How do I get it working with Express versus Koa and all that? They give that to you, and then also too, once you have your Apollo server running, if you visit it just with a web browser, so yeah. a non-GraphQL request, you know, just a regular HTTP get request,
yeah.
they serve this Apollo Playground UI, which is like a nicer version of Graphical.
Oh.
And so then I didn't even have to write any GraphQL queries in my JavaScript app yet. I was just writing them in the Playground.
Wow.
And then I'm like, oh, okay, but I really want to see first name here. So then I alt-tab to the server and I just add first name, alt-tab back to the Playground, and there it is.
Wow, that's so pretty cool.
Yeah, it's the feedback loop and just getting up and running is so fast. Where, you know, if you think about like Rails, it would be like, okay, set up a Rails app, set up some routes, add the Ruby GraphQL gem, which is good, but it's more than just you're in more than just a single file,
mm-hmm.
which
mm-hmm.
was what was so awesome about this.
That's really cool. I mean, if it's that easy to write your own GraphQL server with Apollo, there's a lot of things you could do here. I mean, like, you could even imagine if there was an adapter, or depending on how complex it was, like, that would be a way to, like, account for the SUPA base not having GraphQL, right? You could write resolvers, basically, that just use the SUPA base ORM APIs. Again, you're going to be rewriting a lot of the stuff. You don't want to do that. But you could imagine an adapter existing that just GraphQLified the thing. And then from your client's app's perspective, you don't even know that you're just using GraphQL, you know?
Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
So that's pretty cool. That's pretty neat.
And I guarantee you that it's probably easier to write a resolver that uses Supabase than it is to use the Firebase PHD SDK.
Right, right. Exactly. Oh, that's neat, man. That's really neat. Well, I'll be excited to give that a shot.
Cool. Yeah, I'm be excited to share it.
I'm guessing it'll be ready by like Monday or Tuesday. I mean, you don't have anything new going on in your life, so.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's going to be very, very MVP.
Yeah.
At first. So.
I think if you laser focus on just getting it working for our apps that already exist.
Exactly.
Then we should be able to use it, you know.
Yep.
Cool. All right, we're about 39 minutes. Why don't I touch on this thing? And I know we were talking about getting shorter podcast episodes, but have you ever listened to podcasts and been like, I wish it stopped earlier? I always wish it kept going. So I feel like we're just going to ramble until someone tells us not to.
That is true, because every time I open up an NBA podcast that's over 3 hours, I'm like, just like, yes.
This exactly. That was
so
my
good.
That was my this, other thing is like, what's the most popular podcast in the world? It's like Joe Rogan's like 3-4 hour long. It's also just fun catching up. No, I'll just finish up talking about this thought I had shooting my video. So I add frame or motion to my image cropper, and it's just cool because, man, it's just, again, I've gone over this before, but you know, we built the image cropper using React Use Gesture, so you have all these gesture callbacks for swiping and panning and zooming with pinch, and you're just updating React state, and then you just install frame or motion, you change image to motion.image, and then you just pass where you're doing style equals like left top and transform, you just move those to like animate equals those things instead of style equals those things, and then like it just is all animated. It's just crazy. It's really, really cool how easy it is. Like the progressive, like frame or motion really nailed progressive disclosure of complexity, and the fact that you don't have to do anything. It has sensible defaults, and you can just change the one element you want to animate. You're using React state, you can stay using React state, and then you just swap one prop on it and it works. You don't have to set up a provider, you don't have to set up or context or anything. It's just awesome. And then it just decomposes into all these primitives that you also have access to. So it's just a really, really cool library. But yeah, so like in the video, basically you do that, which is kind of like the high level preferred way to use frame or motion. You know, it nudges you towards declarative animations because it handles all this stuff. For all the reasons that we know declarative UI is good. If something changes, frame or motion can handle, you know, reacting to those changes for you. But in the cropper, I actually didn't want to animate panning or zooming because I want those to basically be one-to-one. But if you pan or zoom too far out of the container and it snaps it back, that's a thing that looked unnatural. So I wanted that to smoothly animate back. So that's why I brought it in. So then I refactor to use these motion values, which are in the library, which are basically like, they're like little mutable bags of state. It's basically what's underneath the motion divs and the animate props. And it's state that lives in JavaScript, but lives outside of React. So you have a use motion value hook. So that is aware of the component's lifecycle. So that frame or motion can clean things up when the component is like unmounted, right? But it is React's rendering is not aware of it. So it's kind of like use ref in that sense. That's kind of how I think about it in a sense. Mm-hmm. You know, use ref is like, as I've gotten more practice with React, I think less about refs as a way to reference DOM elements and more about them as just mutable bags of state that are like React is not listening to or aware of, you know.
It's like they're like render independent, right? They last across all renders.
Exactly. And they don't trigger re-renders. So yeah, you use motion value, you get these little things, and then you can call dot set and dot get on them. And if you pass them into the style prop, Framer Motion knows how to update. Framer Motion will update those properties on the underlying element. But again, you're not triggering a re-render. And so that's how Framer Motion can like use what's the request animation frame to keep things 60 frames per second. So it's perfectly with the gesture library. Because you can be dragging things and, you know, you don't want your entire component tree to just be re-rendering 60 frames a second. There's no reason for it when you're just trying to move or animate the image. So that's really cool. And then basically in that function that like checks if the image has been cropped outside of the container. So if it's like an illegal crop, and then we like recalculate the nearest like legal crop and then snap it to it. Instead of calling x.set and y.set, you use this function animate, you pass it in the motion value, and then you pass in the new value that you want it to animate to. So that kicks off like a promise and it starts animating, but again, it's all outside of React. So it's cool. It's kind of like you've dropped from the declarative world to the imperative world. And it's funny because like one way you know this is that basically, at the end of the video, what I do is I had the crop values in React state originally. Then I move them to motion values. And then it's like, all right, so now that they're in motion values, and by definition, that means React isn't aware of them. So how the heck do you as a React developer even use this image cropper? Because now you've basically made it outside of React. You want at some point to notify the parent that the crop has changed. And you want to get that back into React state, right?
Yeah, is there some like on done animating or something like
exactly,
that?
Exactly, exactly. So that's where we do the adjustment, and that's the natural point to say, basically commit the new crop. But that way, as you're dragging it around or as it's animating, you don't care. But we're already doing it when we have either pinch on pinch end or on drag end, right? Even you just saying that actually made me think another way you could do it is when the animation's done, go ahead and commit it.
Yeah.
But what I did was I left it at the end of the function. So the function animates the values, and then it also calls like an on crop change so that the parent can say, you know, set crop, set state up in the parent. Mm-hmm. So you do that and it's good to go, right?
Do you, hold on, can I ask a question? Do you await the animation there and then call it?
I think I could, but I don't.
Okay.
But I could. It's an interesting question. I guess it's like a UX thing. Like, would you want it to finish and then like the little info bubble tells you the new X value is this? You could totally do that. I don't do that just so like when you finish dropping it, it's done. But the visual thing is secondary, I guess. So what this does is interesting because now that you have the state hoisted in the parent, what if that changes? How do you propagate those changes down back through the component? And also there was this case that I fixed in the video where the animation is running and you want to grab it again so that you want it to be interruptible. So you want to be able to grab the image while it's kind of smoothly going back. So it remains like responsive and fluid. Mm-hmm. But because as soon as you let go, we call set state in the parent, the component re-renders. And so the promises were lost to the previous re-render. So the way I do it first is I call these two calls to animate. They return you these animation controls, which are promises and can be awaited, but also have the stop method that you can use, which I was calling if a new gesture began. But once I hoisted the state out, called set state in the parent, those things were just gone. And it's the same as if, like, let's say a WebSocket event received a new message that the crop had changed from another browser or something like that. It's like Dan Abramov's whole post about you don't want to interrupt the data flow, right? So if you hoist state up, you're making this image cropper, which is basically a fancy form input. And if the props change, you want it to update in response to that. So then you have to answer all these questions. Like if the user's dragging it and you let go and it's like over here, like, and this new state comes down, like how does that, what should that be? How should it respond to that? Should it animate smoothly to the new crop value maybe, or, you know, something like that. So anyways, you can go down a rabbit hole and spend a lot of time on that kind of thing. But basically what I did in the video is I just wanted to solve this kind of like proximate problem of like losing the calls to animate and not being able to call stop anymore. And I was like, oh yeah, just use a ref, because like I need these calls from the previous render accessible in the new render in case they are still running. I want to call stop on them. And it was really cool because it just worked. Basically, like animations was an array that I called stop on in case I needed to. Mm-hmm. But now it was just a ref and they were still there. So it's like, it's just kind of interesting to think about it, where like you want your render to be idempotent and self-contained and pure. But in this case, you're deliberately using a library that goes outside of React so that you can have high performance and it can do things like use request animation frame. But that means you're now leaking the details of your component are by definition deliberately leaking across renders React cycles. So you need some reference to them in this case to be able to basically clean them up in the event that React decides to re-render.
Yeah, I mean, you nailed it there.
And it right? worked it's perfectly.
Yeah, you're going outside of render. Like, it's not declarative anymore. It's imperative. Yeah. And then the fact that it's called, like, stop, this tells you that it's imperative.
Exactly. That's actually a really good point. But it's just really interesting because, like, we ran into this when we did animations back in Ember days. And there is that question of, like, when do you abandon the declarative APIs that it gives you? And you have to know that you're getting into this stuff. You think you're just opting into this one area and then React shows you, or like the app shows you, oh, it's now your responsibility to consider all these different pathways and all these different states that the app can be in. And you didn't even know that Frame or Motion was doing that for you when you use that animate prop, because they're taking care of all that stuff. And now you have to. So just another good lesson there.
You know, it's funny, as you're telling this, it just reminds me, like, over the last few years, I just shiver at any time I, like, start writing something like dot play or dot stop or dot open or dot close. It's just like, oh man, I'm getting into that imperative land, and it's going to wreck me. Where it's like, when you let React render cycle control everything, life's so much easier. But in this case, you can't. I mean, you have to be 60 frames a second. And that's not what React's made for.
Exactly. Yep, exactly. And it is interesting to think about it as like, it is like a limitation of the programming model in a sense. Like the whole point of React is that we get the benefit of declarative UI because just re-rendering every time is fast enough until it isn't. And that you're now basically, you're going outside of the certain part of the programming model and using a different part of it, which is lower level and harder to understand. But, you know, it's just an interesting trade-off. And also, like, my spidey senses are just going off. So, fortunately, I have enough experience to know, like, okay, if this is going to be the messy stuff, make sure as hell to draw a box around this and contain it and have the boundaries of this guy be purely declarative. So from the perspective of the parent that's rendering an image cropper, I'm just going to pass in crop and I'm going to handle an on crop change and I'm going to do my data down actions up thing. And I'm going to make sure, I'm sure there's bugs there still, but that's as you go, you learn those new edge cases and just make it airtight and declarative, right? So if you were going to ship this as like a third party component, you know, there's some other way that crop could change. And so you're going to need to listen to like props did change or, you know, the equivalent, you know, so all that kind of stuff. So it's just really, it's a good exercise in the declarative boundary stuff, imperative shell, declarative boundary or whatever, you know?
Imperative shell, declarative core, right?
I think that was a Gary Bernhardt talk, which was
functional core,
that basically is shell. That basically is it, which is like it's the declarative boundary, but inside you have all this imperative stuff.
Okay, I get it. It's reverse, right? It's like declarative API because you want to render this in JSX, and then imperative mess inside the shell.
Exactly.
By the way, I think as a good, I want to get more experience with this. Go off and write a video player component. I kind of think that's like the best way to get exposed to this. Just because the web video APIs are all imperative, but then you want that sweet, like, you know, is playing true. React rendering API.
Right. Exactly. And you want the player to do the correct thing based on those props changing. That's really where it gets hard, right? Yeah. We ran into the sidebar collapsing in Mirage's website. And it's like, you think it's the simplest thing. It's two states, right? No, it's not, because like you can resize the browser and that like changed things. So, you know, I think it's really because animations or video players or D3 charts, all these things have lots of states, and those states aren't captured in React or even in your logic. Like, it's not even practical or feasible or desirable to capture every state on even something like a transition over a hover object, right? If you have a hover animation, even a Tailwind class that lasts 150 milliseconds, and you go from opacity 0 to opacity 1, you've just introduced 60 times divided by, you know, 1.5 or whatever it is, right? 150 over 1,000 times 60 new states to your application. There's new, that those are, you know, whatever that is, you know, 24 new frames into your app that are represented by the state. If you want to be able to re-render the app in that state, like with a pure React model, then you would need, as a function of state, you would need all of that in state, but like obviously we don't do that. It's totally impractical. And this was one thing I remember Rich Harris talking about in his argument, which is like, this is a lie that UI is a function of state, because the reality is like whether the cursor is blinking, where your mouse position is, like where all this stuff, there's so much stuff in the DOM and in an app that's not captured in state. And so why don't we embrace that and make something that doesn't have these two layers, where one is like, this works great and is super easy to reason about as long as your app's a function of state. And then as soon as you can't do that and you break that, you're thinking about things differently, and it's really, really hard. And you're using effects and thinking about rendering cycles. Whereas like normally when you learn React, it's like you shouldn't have to think about re-renders. Like that's not, you delineate the states and then you describe the UI as a function of those states. And then like, that is literally it. Like React handles the rest, whether you hit the back button or you click something, right? It's like
all the transitions are handled by React. You just define the states and React knows how to go between each of them.
Yeah. So it's just interesting to think about that stuff. But, you know, I think obviously there's a counter argument here, which is just, oh, well, but if 90 to 95% of our app can be modeled like that, it's a huge win. And then for the tough cases, that's where we have like library authors, or that's where you have to get your hands dirty and learn how to do this stuff. And then again, you encapsulate that mess within the component and you expose it in a declarative API. And then it's just as pleasant to use as a button with the on click. So it's just a good lesson you keep learning over and over again. But yeah, it's pretty fun.
Are we going to end up when your series is over with like pinch zoom component with all
hell
these.
No on GitHub. No, I'm not open sourcing this at all. I mean, it's open source. People can copy it into their app, but I'm not going to maintain it because okay. there's so many things.
No, but I know you're not going to do publish a package, but like in the actual code, are we going to see like just a really nice pinch zoom boundary with all this stuff on the inside? I mean, I guess that's what you're doing already.
Yeah. What I have is basically it's an image cropper and it takes a source and it takes in a crop, which is an object that has an X, a Y, and a scale. And then it has an on crop change. Mm. And then you just can say, okay, so either the crop comes from anywhere, let's put it in state, on crop change set state. And then, you know, as the user uses it and does all this gesture stuff and the animations and all this fancy stuff that's going on, you get back the X, Y, and scale values, which you can then use to actually crop it, save the crop version, or just save those coordinates, those scale, the crop factors to your database, or use it like I do in my fitness app, which is I create a version of the cropped version of the image in Canvas and then save that to S3 and get a URL for that. So basically that's where the boundary is. It's the image cropper that just takes in crop and gives you on crop change.
Cool.
So nice. It's pretty sweet. Yeah. But like, yeah, I was thinking about if there's a boundary in between that and like the low level stuff that like use gesture gives you, but like use gesture is basically it, you know what I mean? It's basically, that's why it's such a good library, and that's why I'm able to use it and then add in frame of motion at the end, because it's just giving you the raw events, but doing the nice things. Like, again, you can imagine all the imperative code inside of React Use Gesture, which is like, set up request animation frame, like debounce this thing, like, you know what I mean? All that kind of messy
touch
stuff.
Touch start, touch end, tracking between all those, yeah.
All that stuff is abstracted away behind a really nice declarative use gesture thing, you know? It's just cool. You see the same patterns over and over again, but it's pretty cool. But nice. Yeah, image cropper, surprisingly difficult and surprisingly involved, you know?
Who would have thought?
The gesture stuff is really fun though. It makes me want to do more stuff with it. That plus the animation, like, you know, there's just a lot of potential there. And now that it's cool getting reps in with this library, because I've been following these guys too. They have like this collective called like Poimanders or something. Mm-hmm. And it's like Paul Henschel from React Spring. I think he might've been involved in React Use Gesture. A couple other people who have been involved with like those kinds of projects. And you just follow them on Twitter and they just post like these like amazing like GIFs of just stuff that I'm not doing at all. It's like surprising that we're both call each other ourselves web developers, because like the stuff they're doing is so cool. I'm like, I can build a CRUD form.
Yeah.
I can build a CRUD app. but no, it's really, really neat stuff. So yeah, I'd love to like, it would be fun as like a course or a series or, you know, it'd be fun to start doing some like micro interactions. Like I always think about Things, this app on Mac, and it's just really beautiful and really subtle animations when you pinch and you move things and you double click things. The way it all works is really nice. So it'd be fun to do some videos on like micro interactions with that and making it declarative, wrapping it in declarative boundaries, so it's just as easy for your team to use as like a normal input, you know?
Yep.
So cool stuff. But yeah, I finished recording that today, so that should be up by the time this comes out for sure. It'll be up the 4th or the 5th, Thursday or Friday this week. So
cool.
Yeah.
Nice.
Awesome. Well, hey, let's see if we can do this again next week. Yeah. You had a big week last week.
Yeah.
and now you're getting peed on at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Ryan's a new dad. So
yeah.
He time traveled last week from Monday to Saturday. I didn't know what hit him.
Yeah. Really still don't know, so
you have no idea.
Yeah.
But hopefully we can keep this up, and man, I can't wait until you're back in the office, man. Can you come back? I just wander around the halls of WeWork alone, just sipping my Monster energy drink, looking in the empty offices.
So it's still empty.
It's, I mean, you know, every week I feel like there's like maybe every couple weeks there's like one more person. So like today there actually was someone working in the common areas of our floor. And then on the second floor, I mean, you know, there's people down there making coffee and there's like always a handful of people doing work in the common area. So I still like it just to get out of the apartment and everything.
Yeah.
But it's definitely still dead, man. There's no question. So
nice. I'll be in soon. I'm just, you know, got to get things squared away here. But once we're... Once we got a schedule
some,
and everything.
Yeah, some schedule, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to sneak attack your house and just spray everyone with vaccines. There's no excuses. Is that a safe thing to do?
Yeah. Just, like, tent the house. And
I know you guys have a new baby, but you're not thinking of me, all right? Oh, man. All right, cool. Well, hey, everyone, thanks for listening. If you have any questions, hit us up. Oh, yeah, if you're new... welcome. Thanks for listening. I'm Sam.
I'm Ryan.
Who are you? Yep, you're Ryan. And we like to talk about all the kind of stuff we just talked about. So if you ever have any questions for us, let us know on Twitter at Front and First FM. Someone asked about TypeScript and I realized, yeah, I still haven't learned TypeScript. That's something I need to do. Are you writing anything in TypeScript right now?
No, I have the Next.js TypeScript support is so easy. They just make it so easy.
Yeah.
So we really don't have an excuse. We should just make all of our Next apps TypeScript and then just opt into it when we...
And just learn it like that. Yeah, I agree, man. I've seriously heard like on 4 or 5 podcasts I listen to now, people are like, it took me so long, I finally dove in and now I can't even stand writing JavaScript. It feels like I'm... just like off on without my training wheels, or like I'm just having to keep so much more stuff in my head that when I'm in this flow, this is how one guy described it. I forget who it was, but he's like, I get in this flow where I'm just going and I'm not even thinking about all these little details I used to consider because the compiler just tells me, and I'm just thinking on almost like another level. And when he phrased it like that, I was like, yeah, that's appealing to me. You know, to get more stuff out of my head is always appealing to me.
I mean, that just sounds totally like the paper cuts we were talking about at the beginning of this episode. Just removing that stuff is just so, sounds small, but it's not.
Yep. Cool. All right, everyone. Hope you're having a great week, and we will see you next week. Thanks a lot for listening.
See ya.
Bye.